Coming up on Weekend America.
You've heard how Barack Obama got his start as a community organizer in Chicago, how Chicago taught him everything. So how's Chicago feeling now? We'll check in at a Windy City political hangout and hear how the city feels about its Tuesday night celebration and its president-elect. I'm John Moe. Not everyone in America is celebrating, however. In California, some married people may soon be single after the passage of Proposition 8.
You know, it's amazing that America took such a huge step forward and electing Barack Obama and kind of hopefully putting some of our past behind us. But there's a whole group of people today in California that we're left behind.
As for soccer fans, well, they celebrate all the time.
We love the colors. We follow the teams religiously. So it's religion, you know, and we're trying to bring those traditions over here to the U.S.
Getting you to stay tuned is our goal. Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Okay, the election is over. Now it's time to make sense of it all. We'll do our best to help you in that cause this hour. We'll check in with the state of Alaska, where apparently a felony conviction doesn't hurt your Senate chances all that badly. We'll visit California, where the passage of Proposition 8 has marriages in limbo and emotions still running high. We'll also get away from the ballot box and check in with some soccer fans, where emotions are also running high. Really? Hot-headed soccer fans? You're kidding. I know. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, we are visiting our son at Kenyon College.
I think the new James Bond movie might be coming out, so maybe we'll go see that.
I'm going to get away to Point Reyes.
This weekend, relax, celebrate.
Saturday night, I hope I have a date with the woman I met on Tuesday night from Obama. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've got a friend of mine from college in town that's mooching off of me for the few months, so I'll probably just have to take care of him all weekend and feed him and board him.
Well, at least you have a good attitude about that. Those voices came from San Francisco, Cincinnati, and Washington, D.C. On Tuesday night in Chicago, nearly a quarter million people filled Grant Park to celebrate the election of Barack Obama. They laughed, they cried, they danced, Oprah showed up. In short, they partied as if it was the weekend. Well, now it is the weekend, so how is Chicago feeling today? Ben Calhoun is on the line. He's the political reporter for Chicago Public Radio. Ben, where are you?
Oh, John, I'm at Isola's restaurant, which is about 2 miles south and a little bit west of Barack Obama's house in Hyde Park. More importantly, this restaurant has been here for 50 years, and it is a pillar of Chicago's South Side community. It was a regular hangout for former Chicago Mayor Harold Washington when he was still alive, and also for Barack Obama's political mentor in Springfield, State Senate President Emil Jones. It's a place where people get together on the weekend and they talk about the week's events.
Ben, tell us about the scene Tuesday night in Grant Park. You were there. What was it like?
It was pretty overwhelming. You know, I was in the official rally where there were about 60,000 people, and everyone was watching the returns come in on these jumbotrons on CNN, and they were all sort of hanging on this feeling of disbelief. You just got the sense of that. And it wasn't until, even with the window closing on Senator McCain all night, it wasn't until they got an official declaration when the polls closed on the West Coast at about 10 p.m. here, and CNN officially called it, and then the crowd just exploded. I mean, tears, shouting, cheers. It was really something else. Another amazing scene was when everybody filtered out onto Michigan Avenue, right along the edge of Grant Park there on the city's... on the front of the city, right by the lake. And, you know, you had exuberance like I haven't seen. You had singing, dancing, people were standing on ledges and shouting. There were two older African-American women sitting, taking a rest on their walk home. And these two young white women just ran up and hugged them. They all started yelling, "We did it, we did it." There was also this kind of quiet happiness that people had, that it seemed like they were really trying to wrap their heads and their emotions around the moment, around the historic moment they'd just seen.
So there was this giddiness, this jubilation then. Is that still going on this weekend?
Yeah, it seems like people are really kind of processing what happened. You got the sense that night that witnessing this kind of event, this size of event, it's something that people had to digest, and I think that's what we were seeing when people were walking home, and they were just kind of, you know, quiet-ish. I've noticed that throughout the city. People all week putting it in context, putting it in the context of history and in the context of their own lives. You know, I spoke to one gentleman whose name was Reggie Leslie. He was grabbing breakfast with some of his coworkers before heading off to work. And this was another common thread, which was just that people are still, you know, they're still digesting it. This was how Reggie put it.
Surreal. Unbelievable. It still hasn't really settled in yet, but it will.
What have the conversations that you've had about the election been like since Tuesday?
You know, we're all still, we still can't believe. We can believe, but we still can't believe. Because it's been a long time coming. I mean, we're talking about 200 plus years in existence. Four out of 44 presidents finally won.
And Ben, this week, President-elect Obama announced that Rahm Emanuel, a Chicago congressman, would be the White House chief of staff. We got two Chicago guys in this administration already. What would a Chicago White House be like politically? Or what will it be like, I suppose?
You know, Obama's had an interesting relationship to the Chicago political establishment. He really was able to make his ascent by doing a bit of an end run around the regular Chicago machine, and he's always maintained a certain amount of distance, and he's done so very deliberately. People in Chicago, there was mixed reactions to the Rahm Emanuel pick. I mean, this is a guy who has roots in the Chicago machine, got to start working on current Chicago Mayor Richard Daley's re-election campaign in the late 80s, I believe. So there's a question about whether or not we're going to see more figures like that come out of Chicago and transfer into the administration. But just given Obama's history, you know, we've seen him here be very cautious about how he's managed his distance to Chicago's political reputation, which, you know, as you know, is not the best.
not the most up and up, I suppose.
Yeah, you could say that.
Ben Calhoun, political reporter for Chicago Public Radio. Thanks for filling us in on the Windy City.
Pleasure talking to you, John.
From the home of the winning presidential candidate to the home now of the losing vice presidential candidate, Alaska, where we still don't know the result of Alaska's Senate or congressional races. As of right now, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens is hanging on by a thread, this despite his recent felony conviction in federal court. If he wins, Alaska would be the first state to elect a felon to the Senate. Meanwhile, incumbent Congressman Don Young is also leading his Democratic opponent, despite the fact that the FBI is investigating him for possible corruption. Hey, Alaska, what's going on up there? We're joined by Lori Townsend, host of Alaska News Nightly on the Alaska Public Radio Network. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
So your state seems poised to reelect a convicted felon to the United States Senate. That's something that a lot of people in the other states can't quite figure out. Can you help us figure this out?
Well, there's no question that Ted Stevens is an iconic figure here. People refer to him affectionately as Uncle Ted. He's championed a lot of infrastructure for rural Alaska for a lot of people that don't have much of a political voice in very small villages. So Bush, Alaska really likes Ted Stevens. He also has helped the native corporations here in Alaska. We don't have reservation system. We have native corporations. He's helped open up 8A contracting, Small Business Administration contracting for native corporations so that they could have success with millions of dollars in government contracting. So he has definitely brought home the bacon to Alaska.
Do you think that's why he received all these votes even after the conviction?
I think that's a big part of it. Also, Alaskans are very prickly about people from what they call outside. Anything other than Alaska is considered outside. So a lot of people were upset that a D.C. jury convicted Ted Stevens. They saw it as a kind of a railroad job, and some people just thought it wasn't that big a deal. They compare the money that Ted Stevens has brought to the state against the charges against him, the convictions against him. And one woman in Kodiak said, I figure they steal that much in Washington, D.C. every day, so it's not that big a deal. He's also a war veteran, and veterans are big here in the state. Alaska has more war veterans that per capita than any other state, so that's also a big factor here. People like Ted Stevens.
And Stevens wasn't the only politician from Alaska that is sort of on legal thin ice, so to speak. Tell us about Alaska's sole representative in the House, Don Young, and his situation.
We're not exactly clear yet, because he won't talk about what he's being investigated for, but we know he spent nearly $1.5 million on his legal bills. And we know that he's being looked at for earmarks for a Florida road project, the Coconut Road Project, that would benefit a particular developer who was also a contributor to his campaign. He's also tied to Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist. Mm. There's some serious allegations about aides of his that were connected to Abramoff and favors that Don Young has allegedly received, things such as skybox tickets, things like that. So he definitely has some things that will be surfacing, I would imagine. And who knows what will happen based on what those allegations may be.
It doesn't seem like voters in Alaska are on board this whole idea of change so much.
Well, and you know what? It sort of depends on where in the state, too. Alaska's a big place. In Bush, Alaska, the area that's off the road system, we have many, many communities here that you can't get to, you can't drive to. And those folks show a lot of support for the incumbents because of the track record that they have. And Don Young is married to a Native woman, and so that helps him a lot in those communities, too. People trust him more because of that and feel like they can identify with him. So they still, despite all that's come to pass, they have a tremendous amount of support.
Lori Townsend is the host of Alaska News Nightly on the Alaska Public Radio Network. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Lori says that if Ted Stevens is reelected and is then forced to resign, a special election would be held to replace him. There is debate, however, as to whether Governor Sarah Palin would be able to name an interim replacement. Some speculate that that replacement could be Sarah Palin.
Brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
Thousands of same-sex couples were married in California, but with the passage of Proposition 8, will the state turn them single again? Next on Week in America. Thank you. It's Week in America. I'm John Moe. This is, of course, the show where we talk about what's happening in America this weekend. This next story, however, is about something that is not happening, at least in California this weekend, at least not anymore. Same-sex couples are not getting married. This week, Californians approved Proposition 8, a constitutional amendment that bans same-sex marriage. Supporters of the ban are now discussing legal action to try to invalidate the 17,000 or so same-sex marriages that have taken place in California since they were legalized in June. Meanwhile, three lawsuits have been filed to overturn the ban. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark has been following the story.
It's no surprise that San Francisco has been dancing in the streets to celebrate Barack Obama's historic victory this week.
Obama, baby.
I've never seen so many American flags raised in San Francisco. It's a beautiful thing.
But in the heart of the city's gay neighborhood, one flag has been at half staff since Election Day. A giant rainbow flag at the intersection of Market and Castro Streets. And the joyful noises that rang through San Francisco after Obama's election were drowned out the next day in room 168 at City Hall by a tense hush.
I prefer not to talk at this time. Thank you.
A man, dressed in a suit, sat holding hands with the man next to him. His partner explained they had an appointment for a marriage ceremony.
We already paid for the license last week. Got the license, and they said come back today for 9 o'clock. Well, we've been here since way before the 8:30 or so. We've been actually together 51 years, so we figured it might be all right to, to go ahead and really do it.
Eventually, they were told to go home. In a week where the history of civil rights is on everyone's mind with the election of Barack Obama, Californians are girding themselves for a new type of civil rights battle. But unlike the 60s, when it was clear who held the yoke of oppression, in California, in 2008, everyone flies the flag of justice. If you ask proponents and opponents of Prop 8 who's been wronged, everyone is going to answer, me. Take Heath Mann and his partner. They took off work to try to get married before the same-sex marriage ban was made official. They were turned away.
You know, it's amazing that America took such a huge step forward yesterday in electing Barack Obama, but there's a whole group of people today in California that were left behind, so it's bittersweet.
That feeling has echoed through many parts of San Francisco. Here's Mayor Gavin Newsom, a champion of same-sex marriage, at a press conference after Proposition 8 was passed.
If you did a Prop 8 in 1967 for interracial marriage, would that have been right?
Newsom questioned whether issues like same-sex marriage or interracial marriage should be put to a popular vote. He said when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down miscegenation laws 40 years ago, 77% of Americans still objected to blacks and whites marrying.
Well, I don't think in the history of the civil rights movement that many rights have been advanced by a majority rule. Do any of us look back and say interracial marriage should still be illegal on the day after Barack Obama is elected president of the United States?
Well, if Barack Obama's parents were same-sex married, Barack Obama would have never been born.
Bob Jackson, pastor of Axeful Gospel Church in Oakland, will preach about the miracle of America's first black president this weekend. And he'll thank God for the ban on gay marriage. He sees no inconsistencies there. For Jackson, allowing marriage only between a man and a woman is just different than the racial segregation once aimed at Barack Obama's parents.
It was because of the color on Barack Obama's daddy's face, which was black, and he couldn't change that.
When it comes to sexuality, arguments about genetic determinism don't hold water for Jackson. He believes being gay is a choice.
And I've seen people that are homosexuals, all of a sudden they change their sexual preference and now they're fine, married and have children. But it's very difficult to change the blackness on your face and to change the history that we've gone through for hundreds of years in this country.
And with the breakdown of families in poor black communities like his, Jackson says preserving traditional marriage is that much more important. Whatever the reason, exit polls show that 70% of African Americans voted for California's ban on gay marriage. The same demographic that turned out in record numbers to vote for Barack Obama was also key in the success of Proposition 8, according to Frank Schubert, the head of the Yes on 8 campaign.
People of all stripes, of all ideologies and political backgrounds support traditional marriage and have a real personal connection to this institution and really touches at the core of how people think society should be organized.
Schubert sees the inklings of a new coalition forming over traditional values, one that transcends race and religion and politics.
It'll be interesting to see if the leaders of the various communities can get together and look for common ground. And if they do, they could make a profound difference in how these questions are presented to the public.
1A, no. 2, yes.
Meanwhile, the last of California's votes are still being counted. In Contra Costa County, election workers are going through ballots that couldn't be read by a machine.
8, yes.
There's practically no chance they could change the outcome of Prop 8. It won 52-48%. But in an office upstairs, that outcome is just starting to sink in for Steve Weir. He's the Contra Costa County clerk in charge of elections and the issuing of marriage licenses here. And 6 months ago, once it was legal, he and his partner John got married after being together for 18 years.
You know, I was looking at the rings today and just thinking, my God, am I going to have to take off one of my rings?
I've spoken to Weir several times in the run-up to this election, and he's always been diplomatic and guarded about Prop 8. His mandate was to run a fair and glitch-free election, so he didn't spend much time thinking about how he'd feel if same-sex marriage was banned. Now that it is, he doesn't quite know how to express himself.
You know, a segment of our society, myself included, that haven't chosen to be this way, who want to be good members of society, my lifestyle is being debated in a public forum as if I was a slave on the auction block. I mean, I don't know if people understand how hurtful and harmful that is. I am convinced that folks are going to look back at this and perhaps in our lifetime and go, what were you guys doing? What on earth were you doing?
You know, I think about the woman on the bus issue. I can't remember her name. My mind just went blank.
Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks. Thank you.
Ron Barker uses civil rights metaphors to explain why he voted for Prop 8.
Finally, she got up the nerve to say enough.
He says he wants gay couples to have all the rights that come with marriage, as long as their union is called something else. But if he doesn't take a stand against same-sex marriage, he fears his church might have to start marrying gay couples eventually or lose its tax-exempt status. He feels like his interpretation of the Bible, his religious freedom, is at stake. And when he's called a bigot or intolerant for that, he's insulted.
It's like, I don't want to be anybody that's out there leading the battle, but at the same time, I've had enough. And I think I'm very tolerant of everybody's views. But this time, I just feel like religion is just being pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And that's why I said, I finally feel like I have to stand up for what I believe in. It's time for me to sit at the front of the bus.
This week, in many pulpits around the state, there will be sermons about how traditional marriage and religious freedoms have been protected. And on the other side, there will be protests and candlelight vigils to decry the hate and discrimination of Prop 8. Both will use the language of the oppressed to express themselves. The question is, will anyone be listening? In San Francisco, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
You've seen election analysis on TV, heard it on the radio, read it in the paper and online. Here's a new medium, election analysis by way of mixed tape, ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Week in America. I'm John Moe. And it's time for your letters. A couple of weeks ago, we had a story about Seattle's amateur, well, I'll spell it, P-O-R-N festival. It drew several comments from listeners surprised to hear that type of discussion on a Saturday. The reporter, Liz Jones, doesn't care for the stuff herself. She figures it's due to her religious upbringing. Listener Sean Stromer of St. Paul has this to say.
I know plenty of people who don't seem encumbered by religious guilt who aren't enamored with porn, and who especially wouldn't be interested in attending a party with their husband's coworkers to watch porn in a group. So it struck me as strange to suggest that religious guilt would be the primary reason why you wouldn't want to get together with a big group of people and watch porn.
Last week, the day after Halloween, I talked with Lynn Rosetto Casper, host of American Public Media's The Splendid Table. Lynn helped us find some creative uses for that boring loser trick-or-treat candy. But we picked the wrong ones, according to Alan Perry of Bainbridge Island, Washington.
I'm writing to defend the honor of Tootsie Rolls and Smarties. These are not in any way loser candy. Just to confirm this, I asked my 6-year-old, and he said that he loved those candies, and I could not have the ones that he got for Halloween this year.
I'm sorry you feel that way, Alan, but regarding Tootsie Rolls, I still think you're wrong. I just think they're terrible. I still eat them, though. Speaking of Halloween, a couple of weeks ago, I had an essay about those moments, often in seemingly harmless movies, that scare or scar us as kids, and we got a ton of responses, so I talked with some more of you about your scariest movies, and then we got even more responses, again, often starting with the words, I'll never forget the moment when. What's going on? What's with all the cinematic trauma that is out there in listener land? Dr. Joanne Cantor is Professor Emeritus of Media Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She wrote a book called Mommy, I'm Scared. Dr. Cantor, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you.
Now, tell me about this nerve that I apparently struck. Why do people respond so strongly to these memories?
If you look at the physiology of fear, well, first of all, I should step back and say, why do we have fear in the first place? And fear is an emotion that's very important, and it was originally designed to keep us alive if a predator was coming at us. So we have this fight or flight reaction that's automatic. And so there's a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is a lower level part of the brain, that reacts first, even before we can consciously appraise what we're experiencing. Researchers say that the memories of a really intense fear reaction have to be very strong, because if you were lucky enough to escape that predator the first time, you may not be so lucky the second time.
Well, is there any hope? I mean, like, I come upon this Bigfoot clip, right, in my office after all these years. I watch it. I have to get up and leave my office and walk around for a while, and I'm laughing at myself as I'm doing it, but I'm still doing it. I'm still freaked out.
Well, that's a very good question. There's two ways to go with
it. Help me, Dr. Cantor.
Yes, okay. Well, writing about your fears, it turns out, is very effective in helping you to get over them. So in other words, if you would sit down for 20 minutes and just write about whatever that experience was like to you as you remember it, then put it aside. Then tomorrow, write again, but write it from another perspective, maybe the perspective that you have now. And it's better than leaving it to just kind of go round and round in your brain and not get anywhere.
Dr. Joanne Cantor, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Cantor's latest book is Teddy's TV Troubles. What's your trouble? You can tell us all about it, because apparently now this program is the worldwide clearinghouse for unresolved cinematic fear in America. We never asked for that responsibility, but we're glad to assume it. Go to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This morning, the Jordan Bridge in Chesapeake, Virginia, closed for good. It's the oldest drawbridge in Virginia and a shortcut for many residents to and from the naval shipyards there. We ask those who would be directly affected how they feel about the Jordan Bridge closure.
I'm going to be sad that it's not going to open ever again.
When I first heard the bridge was going to close, I was like, oh my Lord, that means I'm going to have to start getting up at about 4:30 in the morning instead of 5 o'clock so I can make sure I get to work on time.
I've been using the Jordan Bridge a little over 10 years. I'm going to estimate probably 40 minutes to an hour at least each day I save in travel time when the Jordan Bridge is open.
Maybe before my time it might have been, you know, kind of pretty to look at, but, you know, it's pretty darn ugly.
You know, they should have taken care of it before now. They shouldn't have let it go on this long. Hopefully they can build another one.
As of now, there are no plans of building another bridge. The Jordan Bridge will stay in the open position for now and eventually be destroyed. Raymond Harper is a historian in Chesapeake, Virginia, and has been observing the bridge for many years. I asked him what the bridge means to him.
I have known the bridge my entire life because other than the times that I was away in the military, World War II, and college and that kind of thing. So the bridge has been something where I could cross if I needed to go to Portsmouth. I could be in Portsmouth in just a few minutes. But it means a lot more to people who are working over there.
Describe what the bridge looks like.
It's a vertical lift type of bridge. It has a section of roadway between two towers. The middle section of the bridge, there's a house there where the operator is seated. It's a black bridge there on the water, a lot of steel and things of that sort. The bridge was built by two brothers, the Jordan brothers. And at the approach, the South Norfolk approach to that bridge, they had a lumber yard there.
I was just looking at this Jordan Bridge online. When we first brought this topic up, I'm like, oh, it's probably some old cement bridge, but it's it's really beautiful.
It is. It's a very nice bridge. And
what has it been through to get to the state where it is now?
Of course, it's had its ups and downs between then and now. Starting back on June the 2nd, 1939, about 8:30 in the morning, a Texas oil tanker by the name of Rhode Island struck the bridge, and it knocked that portion that lifts. It knocked it 122 feet into the Elizabeth River. And so now we fast forward a little bit to January 2004, the bridge closed. The problem this time was that a tugboat operator misjudged the height of a mast on a barge that he was pulling.
What are the reasons that are being given for closing it now?
Deterioration. The bridge was turned over to the city of Chesapeake in 1977. It has not had the proper preventive maintenance during that time because it's rusted out. There was an inspection of the bridge earlier this year, and they gave it a 3, which meant that the load limit would be 3 tons, you know, of vehicles going across.
What will this mean to people who live and work on either side of this bridge in terms of their day-to-day living?
It means they'll have to detour quite a lot, quite a few miles. And one of the detours will be across another bridge that has been declared unsafe. Of course, that will increase the traffic across that bridge, and it will also increase the traffic through the tunnel from Norfolk to Portsmouth.
Can you even imagine just your life without that bridge being there?
It's definitely going to be different.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, it seems like every once in a while, something that I've been used to my entire life is gone.
Mm.
And the bridge is going to be one of them.
Raymond Harper, historian in Chesapeake, Virginia, thank you so much.
You're certainly welcome.
The The Jordan Bridge is permanently in the up position as of today. When the time comes to destroy it, which might be as soon as next April, the city is expecting to hold a ceremony to honor the bridge's history. Raymond Harper has been asked to write an inscription for a plaque that will go where the bridge once was. Listen for more from our America's Infrastructure series at weekendamerica.org. Tuesday night's election results provoked some intense feelings for many Americans, regardless of who they were supporting. How about you? At that precise instant when your candidate won or lost, what emotions were you feeling? Sometimes those emotions are best expressed by a song. I'm not going to sing, don't worry. We reached out to some friends of the show to find out what song best describes their post-election mood. We're putting these songs together for a post-election mixtape, or playlist, I guess, in an iPod world. Jesse Thorne is the host of the public radio show The Sound of Young America. Although his show is apolitical, he describes himself as...
Let's just say I have San Francisco values. Barack Obama made a very specific choice to remain graceful and continue to offer people hope rather than negativity. And, you know, that sounds kind of naive, but there's something about the way he does it, just like there's something about the way the Impressions sing "We're a Winner" that makes you feel in your heart like everything's going to be okay. It's not an angry song at all, but neither is it a conciliatory song. Essentially, it's a song that says, if we will only accept equality and we remain graceful and hold our heads high, we can't help but win.
Hello, I'm Sophia Dickens, and I'm a television host and a Republican. One song that came to mind was "It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To." That one pretty much speaks for itself. And I actually thought of "A Moment Like This" by Kelly Clarkson. So tell me that you don't think I'm crazy when I tell you love has come here and now. A moment. Every American was touched by the historic moment. We all saw that the American dream is real. I think many Republicans see this win as more of a popularity contest where the qualifications for winning the presidency don't match up with the very serious executive office of the presidency. Republicans took a lot of heat for their beauty pageant VP pick, but the Dems did choose somebody whose performance skills are perhaps better than his governing skills. Everything changes, but beauty remains. Something so tender, I can't explain.
Hi, I'm Raihan Salam. I'm a writer and editor at The Atlantic and a fellow at the New America Foundation, and I consider myself a conservative. There's a really terrific song by King Khan and his Shrines called "Welfare Bread." I remember late in the campaign, John McCain was accusing Barack Obama of wanting to raise your taxes and spend all the money on welfare. And it seemed that Americans were actually pretty excited about that idea. "Welfare Bread" is a song about a man telling a woman he loves that she doesn't have to worry about working anymore. She can just eat his welfare bread, which sounds like, even as a conservative, a pretty charming and lovely idea. So I'm looking for my own slice of welfare bread, and maybe you are too.
Hi, I'm Matt Kaplan. I don't consider myself a Republican or Democrat, but I'm an unrepentant liberal. a song that I had been thinking about going up to the election and hoping that I could play was Everybody Rejoice from the musical The Wiz. I didn't want to, you know, celebrate early. I wouldn't go there. I waited until after the polls had closed in California and Oregon and Washington, and they said, you know, it's no question Obama had won. And then I went back to my computer and I played it. It was great.
Everybody be glad, because the sun is shining just for us. Everybody wake up!
Put up a few more ideas on our website of songs for this moment in history. Check those out. We got anything from Bob Seger, Mahalia Jackson, Randy Newman. Help us create the perfect mixtape. Go to weekendamerica.org. Give us your ideas. Well, it's been a crazy week here in Minnesota for weather. 75 degrees on Monday. By Friday, we woke up to snow. I guess all this change business is for real. For more weather and fun, here's Jeannie Yandel.
Oktoberfest has to be in October, except for the fact it's called Oktoberfest. Philadelphia's Oktoberfest in November has 53 degrees and cloudy skies, good weather for beer guzzling, unless you drink so much you earn the name Bierlikon, which is German for beer corpse. The real Oktoberfest in Munich starts in September. Does any Oktoberfest anywhere actually start in October? The thing about cowboys is they're really sensitive poets. At least Heber City, Utah thinks so at the Cowboy Poetry Gathering and Buckaroo Fair. 60 and sunny for the Cowboy Poetry Train, which means you stay on the train until the end, regardless of the quality of the cowboy poetry. Also, horse shows, jam sessions, and poetry open mic. What rhymes with get along, little doggy? Sheep all over North Carolina are hoping desperately to be mistaken for huge cotton balls. That way they get out of the sheepdog trials in Huntersville. Dogs chase sheep, herd sheep, and intimidate sheep into doing their bidding. 66 and sunny for hayride tours, barrel train rides, and battle axe throwing. Battle axe throwing? Sheep of North Carolina, get out of town now! For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
One big league soccer team, two competing fan clubs. Could be trouble. Well, you know, if I know soccer fans, everyone will stay calm and level-headed. It should all work out fine. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America, supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Well, the MLS playoffs are in full swing. I imagine you're suffering under a wave of MLS fever. MLS? Major League Soccer? No? Well, soccer may be the world's sport, but in the U.S., well, soccer moms get talked about more than soccer players. Still, soccer, or I'll say it, football, fans exist, and tonight at the Home Depot Center near Los Angeles, some very passionate ones will watch their team, Chivas USA, take on Real Salt Lake. Most Chivas fans are Mexican-American. The club has a long history in Mexico before joining MLS, but the team has struggled to find its identity in the United States. It even has two rival fan clubs. Rival fan clubs? Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder explains.
Chivas USA has two fan clubs. One is called Legion 1908. They occupy the seats behind the North Goal. They wear Chivas jerseys and sing songs like this. And Chivas USA's other fan club is called Union Ultras. They occupy the seats behind the South Goal. They also wear Chivas jerseys and sing songs like this.
We are cheering for the Chivas USA. Hey! Chivas USA. Hey! Chivas USA. Hey!
To the casual observer, there's not much difference between these two fan clubs, except that one sings songs in Spanish and the other sings songs in Spanish and English. They're both passionate supporters. They both stand and sing for the entire game. But they don't like each other, and that surprised me. After all, isn't the conflict at sporting events supposed to take place on the field between opposing teams, not between fan clubs of the same team? So I asked the Legion member, Cheo, what up with that?
You know what? I don't want to comment on that. Honestly, it's something that we don't talk about because they don't exist to us. The less we acknowledge them, the better we're off and the better they're off.
I'm going to put the fan club rivalry part of the story on hold for a moment now and talk about a soccer team that doesn't even play in the United States, Chivas USA's big brother. Their name is Chivas Guadalajara.
Chivas Guadalajara is probably the most popular club in Mexico.
That's Nick Green. He writes about soccer for the Los Angeles Daily News. He tells me Chivas Guadalajara is regarded as Mexico's national team.
Because they have a policy of only playing Mexican natives.
A few years ago, Chivas Guadalajara decided to expand and join the U.S. Professional Soccer League, MLS. The team, known as Chivas USA, plays just outside Los Angeles at the Home Depot Center. But Chivas USA is different than Chivas Guadalajara. Their players come from everywhere. Cuba, Switzerland, the United States. That fact isn't significant, though, to the Legion 1908 fan club, because with Chivas USA in Los Angeles, they can go to games and be in the presence of something truly Mexican, the Chivas colors. Not skin colors, the jerseys, red and white stripes. Legion member Ralph Velasios was born in the U.S. He's American. But he tells me being at a Chivas USA game is the next best thing to being in Mexico.
We love the colors. We follow the teams religiously. So it's religion, you know, and we're trying to bring those traditions over here to the U.S.
Traditions like throwing streamers and confetti, playing drums, and singing songs like this one. Even though Chivas USA is playing Houston, the song's lyrics take aim at Guadalajara's Mexican arch rival, Americas. Another Legion member, Jesse, tells me these traditions help define who he is, a Mexican trying to keep his culture alive in America.
On the 4th of July, we have carne asada. We don't have hot dogs and hamburgers, you know. Come Christmas time, we have tamales. We don't have turkey in the hand, you know. So it's a little different, you know.
And come time to support Chivas USA, Jesse will sing songs in Spanish. But earlier this year, that tradition started to bother a few Legion members. They wanted to sing songs specifically about Chivas USA and in English as well. So, as Richard Escuchia tells me, they broke with tradition and formed the other fan club I told you about, the Union Ultras.
Our chants are in English and Spanish, hoping to lure some of the Anglo fans. They're getting to know us, now they trust us, so it's a matter of time before they join us too.
Which is pretty much the definition of assimilation. For Richard, starting the Union Ultras meant bending tradition. For others, like Julio, it meant finding a more hospitable cheering environment.
I was a former Legion member, and the reason I came over here is because they were always like throwing pee on you, smoking weed in front of all the little kids.
The Legion is a brotherhood. Their initiation involves being beaten up by other members. It's a bit like a gang. So it's not surprising that they tried to pick a fight with the ultras. They even wrote a song about them. Finally, Chivas' main office intervened.
They told us, stop it. So we said, you know what, you're right. We will stop because, you know what, they don't matter.
This season, the Legion has gone from being aggressive toward the ultras to being passive-aggressive. When I tell the ultra member, Nemios, what the Legion thinks of them, I'm not surprised that his take is diplomatic.
And you know what? If it's two supporters supporting the same team, all for the better. You know, they'll take care of one side, they'll take care of the other side.
And tonight, both fan clubs hope Chivas USA will take care of what's in between. In Carson, California, I'm Charlie Schroeder for Weekend America.
Hey, you want to help us with a story? We're in the thick of the holiday season now, right? Next up, Thanksgiving, turkey, stuffing, gratitude, trying to figure out why pilgrims' hats had buckles on them. Seriously, did they need to tighten their hats? Like, oh, I ate too much turkey. Let me loosen my hat. Okay, I digress. Helping us with the story, right? We're producing a special program for the weekend after Thanksgiving, and we're looking for stories about home. We'd like to hear yours. What's the most memorable homecoming you've ever had? What's a house you'll never forget? Have you ever been through a crazy time trying to buy or sell or inherit or save a home? In short, what does home mean to you? That's going to be kind of the focus of that show. We want to hear your thoughts. Go to weekendamerica.org and tell us. It's up there on the right-hand side of the page. And that does it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of the entire program at weekendamerica.org. It's also available at iTunes. You can set it to feed into your computer automatically. You don't need to worry about a thing. Then you have a little bit of weekend that you can carry with you all through the week. It'll make your week that much more enjoyable, I promise. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Everyone wants to feel wanted, even basketball fans. I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, I become a fan free agent. See, the team I used to follow left town, so now I'm free to sign with any team in the NBA. Let the bidding commence.
I am absolutely welcoming you into our franchise. We could use some fans right now, and yeah, you're part of the blueprint, absolutely.
Minnesota sounds tempting, but Memphis and Phoenix make their pitches too. Join us.